Welcome to the Repair Ed podcast, where we reflect on education and reimagine equitable futures. I'm Claire Neves, a researcher who worked in education in the city of Bristol in the southwest of England for over 15 years. In each episode, I'll talk to educators and thinkers about current injustices in our schooling system and their ideas for creating fairer educational futures. This podcast forms part of Repair Ed, a five-year project funded by UKRI to examine educational inequality in Bristol's primary schools. Welcome to another episode of the Repair Ed podcast. My guest today is Charlotte Orpin-Wright, a regional delivery lead for the Education Endowment Foundation and a former teacher. In fact, we both taught at the same school many years ago. Afternoon, Charlotte. So you're here in a personal capacity today, although we're hoping that some of your knowledge of the data through your role in the EEF will be really interesting for our listeners, especially those who are local to Bristol in the southwest. Can you share a bit about your journey into teaching and then how you ended up in your current role?
Yeah, absolutely. Hi, Claire. Great to see you today. So I was a teacher for around 12 years. I taught originally for 2.5 years in South America, actually, in Argentina. Buenos Aires, in an international school there. I was a teacher of English, and then I came back to England and qualified through TeachFest back in 2013. I was one of the first, the first cohort in the southwest. So I taught in a South Bristol school, in fact the school where Claire and I met, and then I continued to teach in Bristol schools until 2023. And I took on various middle and senior leadership roles across that time before moving over to the Education Endowment Foundation, where I now work as the regional lead for the southwest and south coast of England.
Great, thank you. Could you explain a little bit about what the Educational Endowment Foundation does?
Yeah, absolutely. So we're an independent charity dedicated to breaking the link between family income and educational attainment. So essentially at the EEF, we believe that the amount of money your parents or carers earn should not dictate your outcomes in education. And unfortunately, the data shows us right now that there is a huge link, and it's something we're working hard to try and address.
Great, thank you. So our project, Repair Ed, focuses on educational inequality. And I know you've got, as you said, some particular insight into economic disadvantage through your work. So would you be able to share a bit of the data from the Southwest and perhaps Bristol in particular?
Yeah, absolutely. So the Education Policy Institute, I'll call them the EPI in this talk today, they've recently released a report in 2025, just in September actually, looking at the gaps in months in terms of attainment for children at all key stages, so from early years right the way through to key stage five. So I mean, that's a great place to start when we're thinking about data. So if we think about early years, you know, right at the start of a child's journey, the national picture in England right now is that even at that early stage, there's a 4.7 month gap between children who receive free school meals and children who do not. That gap widens again nationally into key stage two, where it's around 10 months difference in learning. And then finally, by key stage four, there's a 19.1 gap in learning between those groups of children. And unfortunately in Bristol, the gap's even bigger at every single key stage. So in early years, there's a 5 month gap in Bristol, and then it widens to 13 months at key stage two, and then into 22.4 months. So nearly 2 years worth of learning gap by the end of key stage four, those crucial GCSE results.
I was gonna say, what does that gap actually mean? So is that comparing kind of end of key stage outcomes?
Like exactly, statutory? So it's using the national data points. Mm-hmm. So looking at GCSE results, SATs at the end of key stage two, year six, and then good level of development in early years. So it's a really stark picture to be faced with, you know, in 2025, that there's such poor outcomes for children who receive free school meals compared to children who do not. And it's something that at the EEF we're deeply concerned about. And in fact, you know, interestingly, pre-pandemic, there was sort of a 10-year period where the gaps at all key stages were closing. You know, real you could call it sort of rapid narrowing over the 10 years before the pandemic, and then unfortunately during COVID the gap widening, I mean, it took place for every group of children, but actually the biggest gap widening took place within socioeconomically disadvantaged children's households. And so now really we're still reeling from that as a country, trying to close those gaps again. But when you look at the data, it's almost 10 years of lost progress that's happened. So yeah, it's a big job for school leaders and teachers to try to overcome that now.
And I know that it's something that school leaders and teachers are directed to focus on in terms of addressing those gaps. For those listeners who aren't teachers, do you want to explain a bit about sort of how we categorise these children? So you've mentioned free school meals, and then there's the pupil premium. So what's kind of the intention with the pupil premium?
Yeah, so pupil premium exists as a way to essentially give schools some money, a premium, for children who are either living in poverty, and that's defined by children who receive free school meals. So you're only entitled to free school meals if you meet certain criteria. It's now based on universal credit, and in the past it was to do with family income. So that's one way that you'd be classed as pupil premium. And then another way is if you're a looked after or previously looked after child, so if you've been in the care system. Interestingly, actually, at the EEF, we tend to focus, when we do our data analysis, we look specifically at those in receipt of free school meals. That's because our brief is around socioeconomic disadvantage. And of course, there's lots of children, you know, perhaps who are adopted, who are actually then in wealthier families. So, however, the way pupil premium works is those children are included within the categorisation as well, because they will be vulnerable in their own ways as well.
Yeah, so there's that distinction between pupil premium and in receipt of free school meals, which is specifically economically disadvantaged. I'm just wondering, actually, because I came out of teaching a while back, and the difference between basing pupil premium or free school meals on income versus universal credit, does that mean that there are potentially families who would be entitled to benefits who aren't claiming them, who therefore then aren't in receipt of free school meals and could be?
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a huge, that's a real problem across the country, but especially in rural communities. There can be stigma attached to signing up to receive free school meals, and especially in schools where actually there's fewer families taking up those meals, it can be a real struggle for teachers trying to encourage families to claim them when they're entitled to them, because they don't want the stigma of it. And then that means that premium, that money that's really there for the children to have that extra input in school, isn't being claimed by the school, so that doesn't help.
And that amount of money varies vastly from school to school, doesn't it? Because, of course, children who are in receipt of free school meals aren't evenly distributed across. And we've got a map on our website which shows kind of the distribution. And it's really unequal, isn't it?
Absolutely. So, you know, a big inner city secondary school, their people premium funding could be hundreds of thousands, versus a small, you know, one form entry primary school in a rural community, we might be talking a few hundred pounds a year. And so what schools can then do with that money varies drastically, and it's important, I think, that schools are really taking the time to look into how they're spending their money. There's better and worse ways to do that. I think that's something we might touch on later on in the podcast.
Yeah, well, let's get into talking about schools, because you worked in Bristol for over a decade as a teacher and a senior leader. So what was your experience as a teacher in Bristol?
Yeah, I mean, I think I find it quite hard to answer a question like that, because I worked in quite different schools. So originally worked with yourself, Claire, in a South Bristol school. Very high numbers of children who were PP, and a very particular I guess kind of demographic of children there. And then I worked in a central Bristol school, which was just very different in terms of the student population. Mm. Again, still a large number of children receiving free school meals, but actually what that looked like, the needs of those communities were really different, even within Bristol. Mm. For example, the school I worked at most recently, lots of children who were international, who'd come from other countries, and so perhaps English was not their first language, and there was sometimes challenges around that, but actually perhaps had families that were really keen for them to do well within the English education system. Mm-hmm. So kind of quite different, just different children, different needs. And so I guess, yeah, Bristol as a whole, I find it hard to comment on that. It's a diverse city with mm-hmm. That has a diverse set of needs, as it should, which would reflect the student population. So I think ultimately there won't be one kind of fix-all solution, as there never is with tricky problems.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the ideas that we're working with on the project is around Bristol being this divided city. And so you worked in a few schools around Bristol. Was that your experience, that kind of communities were very different? I mean, from the outside, Bristol is a really diverse city, but kind of when it comes to individual school communities, was that diversity there, or were they very different, the schools you worked in?
Yeah, I think my experience with the South Bristol school was it served the South Bristol community that was immediately outside the school gates, and that was a very different community to the school that I then worked at in central Bristol. I worked in secondary schools, and mm-hmm. actually my central Bristol secondary school did serve a lot of Bristol because of the nature of it was on bus routes essentially, mm-hmm. so children could get there from lots of different places, which was very different to the South Bristol school, where actually everyone was just within, you know, almost within walking distance of yeah. that school. But I think with primary schools, it's even more pronounced, mm. where they're smaller, they have smaller catchment areas. And so, the quality of each primary school is very different in Bristol, even just a few miles apart, mm. because of, as you described, serving those different communities.
Yeah, there's sort of really distinct challenges in each of the schools. And I think it's sort of important to acknowledge that whilst your work is around educational disadvantage, there are lots of other factors at play, aren't there? You know, there's racism, there's classism, the special educational needs system needs a complete overhaul. You know, there's so many factors at play that if you think about kind of your knowledge and understanding of the statistics and then your experience in classrooms and working with families, what do you think are the biggest barriers to equity in education at the moment?
Oh, such a big question. I think, look, high quality teaching is one of, if not the biggest lever we as educators have to improve outcomes for disadvantaged children. I think, the practitioner ultimately is the intervention. And yet in England, we're facing worsening shortages of qualified teachers, particularly in secondary STEM subjects, but actually really across the board. And a large part of this shortage kind of reflects declining rates of retention among early mm-hmm. career teachers, and also female teachers in their early 30s leaving in droves. And we know that this recruitment and retention crisis is hitting all schools, but actually schools serving poorer communities are being impacted the most by these issues. So the April 2025 EPI report examined the differences between teaching workforces in schools and compared sort of the most advantaged and disadvantaged pupils and the schooling they were receiving. And it found these substantial and persistent gaps in terms of teacher experience in the classroom, who was in front of these children was radically different depending on the communities that mm-hmm. those schools served, as well as in subject expertise and staff turnover and absent rates. So for example, teachers in disadvantaged schools just are less experienced. On average, they have 3 years less teaching experience than those in less wow. disadvantaged schools. That's a national picture, but I don't see any reason why that wouldn't be the case in Bristol as well. And interestingly, school leadership experience gaps have widened as well in recent years, and that's new. So there's been gaps in experience for a while across the board in teachers in front of children, but actually recently the leadership gaps have grown as well. So head teachers in the most disadvantaged schools have on average 3 years less experience than those in more affluent schools.
Wow. And you could argue they have a harder job. Well, as well.
That also plays out in the stats as well. So the average, the turnover rate of staff is around 7 to 8% higher in schools that serve more disadvantaged communities. So when I'm talking about, you know, how do we change things, how do we improve things, you know, we need high quality teaching to be going on, and we need leaders, experienced leaders. And at the moment, schools serving disadvantaged communities are really missing out, I suppose, on that. So I think, you know, we need to incentivize somehow, you know, we need to incentivize the best teachers to work in schools which need them most. And so that could be a financial incentive, but it could also be a more sort of creative approach. For example, like a 9-day working fortnight is something that the EEF is doing an evaluation of at the moment. So thinking about whether that has an impact on teacher retention, if you can be more flexible and sort of creative in thinking about how to retain teachers.
There is an Academy Trust that's implemented that, isn't there?
That's the one that the EEF is evaluating right now. So it's the Dixon Academy Trust. Yeah. So it involves changing teachers' contractual hours to give them an extra day off a fortnight, but with no reduction in salary.
Yeah.
So it'll be really interesting to see the impact that has on staff retention. I mean, the initial data from the trial is really positive. So it's been positively received by staff, of course. But, you know, job satisfaction has gone up. There's fewer claiming that they're thinking about leaving. But it will be a while yet until the final evaluation is out. So, yeah, watch this space.
And I suppose that flexibility, sort of going off track here, but it's something I'm really interested in, that flexibility would do a lot to address that demographic of women in their 30s being a huge group who leave. Conscious that we both left teaching as, you know, women in our 30s. And, you know, a lot of that is down to caring responsibilities which fall mainly on women, and it just not being compatible with teaching as a career.
That's it. I think work-life balance ultimately changes as you age, and I think you and I have both experienced it as women in schools, and I think actually that's something that we need to think hard about, because these are the teachers we want to hold on to and who ultimately should then go on and be leading schools, and yet we're losing them in droves. I think another thing as well around another barrier really is just around the understanding of disadvantage. So this is something I see a lot in the Southwest. Just to truly change things and improve things within a school, there needs to be a real understanding of the needs of disadvantaged pupils, and that needs to avoid deficit narratives, and by deficit narratives I mean kind of the stories that one might tell themselves around certain pupils, that actually, you know, that sometimes I've heard, for example, socioeconomic disadvantage being somehow grouped together with lower ability or lower aspiration, and those things are completely separate. Right, so that still goes on in schools, where there's an assumption that perhaps, oh, you know, that family doesn't value education, that child doesn't have high aspirations for themselves, and so therefore they're not going to do well. And it's incredibly unhelpful, and it's untrue. The EEF's done research into this, and actually children from socioeconomically disadvantaged households do not have lower aspirations than children from any other households. Their families do not care less about education than other families. In fact, it might be that those narratives are almost pushed onto the children, and they take them on themselves. Mm. Or as they go up through the education system, the barriers really are things like a lack of opportunity, a lack of choice, a lack of availability to resources that their peers do have available to them. And that's gap widening, right? So I think we need educators, we need school leaders and teachers to have really spent time thinking about that and understanding that, because you need to be quite a skilled practitioner, I think, to understand the nuance of that and then actually work out what it is that your disadvantaged pupils need and the community that you serve needs. And so, yeah, we need head teachers to give staff time to do that thinking and really understand the context in which their school is placed. So, you know, and that might involve pupil voice, it might involve parent voice, it really should involve kind of bringing the community into schools, I think, to understand what's going to make the difference here rather than making assumptions.
Absolutely. And I think one of the things that comes out in a lot of this, you know, whether it's research or, you know, just general kind of discourse around educational disadvantage and deficit narratives, is that quite often teachers and school leaders don't share the same background as the pupils that they're teaching, and they come in with almost this kind of savior complex of, you know, it came to mind when you were talking about incentivizing working in disadvantaged schools earlier. So that sounds great, but we need to do that in a way that avoids kind of a doubling down of that savior mentality of, you know, I'm a middle class, usually white teacher who's going to go in and you know, save these disadvantaged children from their awful upbringings and backgrounds. And because that's really pervasive, isn't it? And I think there's a lot at the moment around white working class boys, although, you know, I think this week as we're recording this, there's been an article written about now white working class girls are the forgotten. You know, and there's so much kind of deficit narrative that plays into that, you know, even kind of putting aside the race issue, where, you know, when we talk about working class, we're not talking about white children. You know, there are plenty of black and brown families who are working class. But yeah, it's really difficult, I think, avoiding that deficit thinking. And we talked a bit about it in another episode with Curtis from Class 13, and they're really, really good to check out on deficit narratives. I think let's come to hope, because, you know, that's, you've sort of started talking a little bit about what would make a difference, but, you know, where is the hope in the system? Are there any examples of schools or areas that are doing really, really well in tackling disadvantage, or, you know, what are the strategies that are having an impact?
I think, I mean, thinking about approaches and strategies, a big thing that we have to acknowledge is the pupil premium. So the money that's given directly to schools, you know, it's essentially the biggest redistribution of wealth that this country's ever seen, with the aim of improving outcomes for socioeconomically disadvantaged children. It's a hard-won policy that should be there to try and make a difference. Now, there's better and worse ways to spend that money, and the EF looked at that a lot. So I think, you know, there's hope in that, because we've got examples, you know, from across the country of schools doing incredible things with that. I think, you know, the guide to pupil premium is a great place to start. There's that's on the EF website, but I think schools thinking hard about what they're doing with that money to really have the best impact on teaching and learning is hugely important. I think partnership feels really important right now. And so whether that's thinking locally, regionally, nationally, sort of system level change feels so important. You know, having worked in schools for 12 years, we know how busy and how stretched school staff are, including leadership teams, perhaps especially leadership teams and head teachers. This is a really sticky problem in terms of, you know, I started off with the data. The data's gotten worse in recent years in terms of the poor outcomes for disadvantaged children. And so just sort of expecting schools to manage that themselves, or head teachers to sort them out themselves, that doesn't feel like the right approach anymore. There needs to be more middle tier organizations like Repair Ed and like the EF thinking, you know, wholesale about this and really trying to work with head teachers, with local authorities, with multi-academy trusts in partnership to move things forward. And there is that work going on, and I think there is hope in that. And I think finally, just we do have more knowledge now than we did 15 years ago about what works well mm-hmm. for disadvantaged pupils in terms of high quality teaching and learning, in terms of approaches. And so even though there's absolutely no silver bullet, there never will be, everything's got to be, you know, all evidence research has to then be taken alongside contextual understanding and professional knowledge. We do have some things that you can use as a teacher now to say, right, you know, in my school, we know that literacy is one of our biggest areas that our disadvantaged children are underachieving in. Well, we've got some stuff on that, right? There's guidance reports, there's the Teacher's Toolkit online, which the Education Endowment Foundation has created, which essentially synthesizes peer-reviewed evidence from hundreds, if not thousands, of studies, of trials, and gives you your best bets mm-hmm. about what will work. We're not saying that this will definitely fix you know, the challenge in your school, but it's a best bet, right? Because we've done these trials at scale, and it's a bit of a numbers game. Once you've done a randomized controlled trial, you know, with enough schools, it's more likely mm-hmm. that it will also work in your school as well. So I think that's a huge hope, that schools will continue to use those resources and really tailor what they're doing to think about the children who need it most, which the data tells us is the socioeconomic disadvantaged children.
Do you do any analysis at the EEF around, just thinking, you said that, you know, these are the children who need it most. Does the EEF work at all with other characteristics like race, like special educational needs, or is it just economic disadvantage?
Our brief is to improve outcomes mm-hmm. for socioeconomically disadvantaged children. We care deeply about all children, and SEND is something that we talk about and think about a fair bit, actually, if I'm honest, when I go out mm-hmm. and speak to head teachers, because it's such a live issue right now in the mm-hmm. system. We say some things about it. We have a guidance report about SEND in the mainstream, and we've worked a lot with Gary Aubin, mm-hmm. so we have bits and pieces, but actually that's not our work. And it's sort of, I guess it's about not trying to do too many things and spreading ourselves thinly, but you know, there are great organizations out there, and I think we can all agree that the SEND system right now does indeed need an overhaul, and there's work going on to do that, so we're sort of watching with bated breath at the EEF to see how that plays out.
I want to ask what might be quite a provocative question, but I'm sure it's one that you've been asked before, if not you personally, but the EEF, because you talked about the pupil premium funding as like wealth redistribution. So why not, you know, just give that money directly to families to try and lift them out of poverty?
I guess it's a tough question, but I guess, I mean, that money's come from the Department for Education. Mm-hmm. So that's the pot yeah. where the foundation yeah. money has come from. I guess, yeah, that's a kind of government policy question, isn't
and
it?
And I suppose
someone's made the decision that's...
It's not much money per individual child, is it?
Yeah.
You know, so thinking about the kind of things that you can do with that money that will have... You know, so like you said, there are schools where it's, you know, thousands and thousands, so you can work at scale, put all that funding together, but sort of for an individual family, that money wouldn't go very far.
And it's about the value of education and what education can mean to a child and a family long term, right? Mm-hmm. If you know, success in education, and this is something the EEF does talk about a lot, it's we're not in it because we care about grades. It's about the life chances that this then provides, and the choice that it then provides to that child for the rest of their lives. And actually, you know, in terms of, yes, it's about the grades tell us something, but actually when you look at things like health outcomes for children long term, that can correlate quite closely with how they've done at school, because what it means is it can lead to all sorts of changes in terms of what food they're able to eat as they grow up, what sort of things they're exposed to or not exposed to. It can change the direction of a child's life. And so, yeah, it feels investing in education ultimately is another lever, isn't it? It's another way to try and, I guess, yeah, it's another form of social justice ultimately, to improve people's lives.
Yeah, and one of the things that we're writing a paper on at the moment is organised abandonment. So looking at applying that theory to kind of the intentional disinvestment in certain communities. And, you know, one of the things that we're arguing is that where this happens, you're not only kind of depriving children in schools of, you know, quality education in the moment and communities of what they need more widely, but you're foreclosing educational futures because, as you say, education has such a big impact on what people go on to do. And, you know, Kezia talked on the podcast around, you know, measuring outcomes. Yeah, it's not just about grades. You know, she was saying, judge me on what those kids are doing, you know, by the time they get to 25, where's their life started to take them? And yeah, so I think investing in education is obviously, you know, something that we all want to see. So I think that's a good time to ask our final question, which is the same for all guests on this first series of the podcast. What would a just education system look like to you?
So I think ultimately it would be a system that allows children from all backgrounds to thrive. It would have a curriculum that excites and inspires and serves the students who study it, and schools would be places of inclusion and hope and achievement and celebration for all.
That's a really, really lovely vision, which I wholeheartedly agree with. And I think that notion of serving the community comes back to our earlier discussions around how diverse those communities are and how distinct they are. And, you know, it's not necessarily going to be the same in every school, but it needs to work. And, you know, you mentioned senior leaders and teachers really understanding the communities that they work with, and it's absolutely vital.
And I think that, yeah, thank you. I think something that I almost had to balance when I was moving from sort of senior leadership in schools into working for the EEF was really, I think evidence research can sometimes feel very blanket, kind of. It can feel very much like, this is what you do these things. And I think it's really important to acknowledge, A, that EEF isn't saying that, but B, we as school leaders, system leaders in education need to really always take in the contextual factors, because every school is different, every child is different, and what research evidence tells us is that it's a best bet, right? But you have to combine that with the professional knowledge of that school that the school leaders will bring, and also the contextual information as well. And so there's three parts to that puzzle, and you need all three to move forward, I think.
Great. Thank you so much, Charlotte. It's been really good talking to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Repair Ed podcast. Please take a listen to our other episodes, and if you'd like to be a guest, get in touch. Our email can be found on our website, www.repair-ed.uk.